Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. About a month from now, voters in Russia will be electing a new president, and it is widely expected that the winner will be the former president and the current prime minister, Vladimir Putin. Although his victory seems to be assured, he is not as popular as he once was, and his party suffered serious losses in parliamentary elections held in December. In this part of the program, we will be talking about Russian politics. We'll try to talk a little bit about relations between Russia and the United States. And our guest is Dr. Andrew Cutchins. He is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia program. He's an internationally known expert on Russia, its politics, its foreign domestic policies. He also has worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he was director of its Russian and Eurasian program in Washington, D.C. And then before that, he was director of the Carnegie Moscow Center in Russia. He's visiting the campus. His visit here, sponsored by the folks at the program in the Russian East European and Eurasian Center, and he was here to give a talk. And we're really very happy that he could spend some time with us talking this morning. So questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Delighted to be here, David.
Well, Vladimir Putin served two terms as president of Russia. It's a term-limited position, so when he came to the end of the second term, he had to step down, which he did. And at the time, I'm sure that no one thought this man was going to retire from politics. So he went on and became prime minister, and then last fall announced that he was going to run again for president. And I'm sure that surprised no one. Maybe I should ask that question. Anybody surprised that he followed this scenario?
No, I don't think there was a great deal of surprise on anybody's part inside Russia or outside Russia. I think the expectation was that he could have chosen not to run for the presidency, and that would have also not been so surprising. But as you alluded to, David, I don't think anyone expected him to retire from politics and move on to something else. 4 years ago, that was certainly the case. I think that was also the feeling coming into this electoral cycle in Russia.
Yeah. There was a bit of a surprise, I think, when you look at the reactions to the parliamentary elections in December. And maybe first I should just ask you to talk about that and talk about the significance of the voting and the outcome of that voting.
Well, the outcome of the voting was significant, that the United Russia Party, the leading party of Russia, and the party which Mr. Putin was closely associated with, although he's always kind of kept his distance, a bit of distance with the party. They only received about 49%+ of the vote, and that was about 15% lower than what they'd received in December of 2007. So it still was a major. They had a major plurality of the vote, and maintained their majority within the Duma. But it was certainly an electoral setback for them, and by association, an electoral setback for Vladimir Putin. And if we look upon his career on the national political stage, going back to when he emerged in late 1999 as the prime minister, and then was designated by then President Boris Yeltsin as acting president when he retired. This marked really the first major electoral setback that Mr. Putin had experienced over the course of more than a decade in national politics in Russia.
Yeah. Well, that prompts the question, why? Why is it that someone who had enjoyed really very high levels of popularity should, it seemingly in a pretty short period of time here, experience a pretty significant reversal?
I think the explanation lies in the changing nature of Russian society. When Vladimir Putin first emerged on the scene 12 years ago, Russian society was fairly monolithic, that there was not a large middle class at that point. The Russian economy has grown quite robustly over the course of more than a decade right now, with the exception of the blip with the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. But, you know, the Russians today are more prosperous than they ever have been in their history, relatively. Russians that identify themselves as middle class, and those that actually live at middle class standards, are now upwards of 25-30% of the population, and they're growing rapidly. And so those that have actually benefited by the economic growth that has taken place during Vladimir Putin's tenure, they have reached a level where simply continued economic growth is not all they want. And we see this around the world in a number of different cases historically over the past few decades, whether it's Asia or Latin America or Southeastern Europe, as countries reach a certain per capita GDP income, and it tends to be around $10,000 a head, then people become have greater demands for better governance, more pluralism, more say in how their country is governed, less corruption, etc. And I think that's what we're seeing today in response with the parliamentary elections and the response to the parliamentary elections. Yeah. This is – and that the Russian society today is actually quite polarized. And you have a large and growing middle class that have what we would identify as more modern values and versus a more traditionalist society. And the larger middle class, they tend to be more located in large urban areas, although they're growing in the countryside as well. But so you have these kind of two camps in Russia, and they are increasingly the values that they hold are different. And the monolithic centralized political system, which Vladimir Putin so assiduously constructed over the course of his tenure in the past 10-plus years, which doesn't allow for competition, really. It doesn't fit the values and the aspirations of these increasingly wealthy middle class Russians.
Yeah, and those people are the ones that have turned out for these big street demonstrations.
Yeah, these are the people coming out in the streets. These are again the people that have actually benefited. These are not the people that are feeling disenfranchised with what is. Well, they are feeling disenfranchised in that they don't have a political party or a political system which they feel that their desires and their ambitions answer to. Mm-hmm. And they look into the future and they see that the potential for, well, gosh, this guy Vladimir Putin, the system that he's created, you know, do we really want to be in this country for another 10 or 12 years under this kind of system? And I think increasingly the answer is no.
Yeah. Just talking a little bit more about the parliamentary elections in December, I think officially United Russia, Mr. Putin's party, got a bare majority in the Duma. I think, though, at least some of the things I've read suggest that some people think that, in fact, they did not get 50% or over 50%, and that part of what people were unhappy about was the feeling that that fraud had taken place. Is there any way of knowing, in fact, was there fraud and how much and how important it might have been?
Well, I think we can agree that there's no question that there was some fraud and falsification of the Duma results. But I think it's also virtually impossible to clearly designate how extensive and how high the fraud was. I was in Moscow just about a week or so after the Duma elections, and I met with a number of opposition party officials and opposition figures, and they were claiming at the time that the actual number for the United Russia was more 30-35% of the vote. And that as early polling results came in from the Russian Far East and eastern portions of the country, which are many hours ahead in the time zone, they saw that the officials were concerned about the potential of what they would view as a disastrous result to the election. It's one thing to drop 15% or so, from your previous position to around 50, but to drop about 30% and have the results. That was viewed as unacceptable. And so that mobilized, in their view, in European Russia, and especially in the big cities, St. Petersburg and Moscow, which ironically, of course, are the biggest strongholds of this kind of liberal opposition, middle class constituency, to address that. Now, the problem with that explanation is that if you look at the pre-polling data and the post-polling data of the elections, those surveys are pretty much in line with what the election results were. Mm-hmm. So it may be, it's very hard to prove, and the data which exists suggests that the level of falsification was not as high as the opposition claimed. But nevertheless, it was there. And, you know, you have people with cell phones taking photos of clear violations of voting procedures at different voting stations. And then those go on the Internet, they go viral, and the movement really accelerates.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Andrew Cutchins. He is a senior fellow and director of the Russian and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Russia and recent events there. The questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody here, in fact, who's ready to go. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Email is also welcome, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Coles County. We'll talk with them on our toll-free line, line four.
Yes, I thought I would mention that one of the biggest problems in Russia seems to be ultra-nationalism and the associated racism. It seems like almost all the major parties are nationalistic. Putin's United Russia Party is pretty nationalistic. Even the Communist Party is somewhat nationalistic. And, of course, you have that other third party, I can't think of the name of it, that is ultra-nationalistic. Would you agree that this is one of the big problems is sort of dislike of almost anybody who isn't a Russian and any grouping that isn't traditionally Russian, that's one of the biggest problems today?
Well, I think you're right in that Russian nationalism has been growing over the course of the last 10, 15 years, and that all elements within the Russian political system find themselves compelled to appeal to aspects more nationalistic themes in their rhetoric and in their policies. Now, yes. It's somewhat dangerous because the possibility of we've seen a number of instances and increasingly frequent instances of nationalist violence, skinhead violence against foreign workers from Central Asia, from the Caucasus, and that latent discrimination and racist elements that exist within the population. They're certainly not the majority of the population, but they exist. And the government, as well as the contending political parties, do find they need to try to appeal to that. And we see that's become controversial, actually, within the opposition and the protests that have taken place over the past couple of months. And in fact, the most charismatic of the opposition figures that has emerged, Alexei Navalny, a young lawyer, 35, 36 years old, who's been noteworthy for the blog that he writes in his efforts, is really an anti-corruption blog, and also his efforts to try to expose and to take to court large companies that are state companies that are engaged in very corrupt practices. He has been accused by some of his liberal colleagues of being excessively nationalistic, and some of them don't particularly want to be associated with him.
Yeah.
So, in fact, in the demonstrations that are scheduled for tomorrow, you see that there's one main opposition demonstration where about apparently 27,000-30,000 people as of this morning I saw had signed up. And then there's a smaller splinter opposition, kind of liberal opposition group, which is also going to be holding a march, but they don't want to be associated with this what they perceive to be the nationalists in the mainstream of the opposition.
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, I think this is an interesting question, and one of the things I definitely wanted to ask you about, because there are these two streams in the opposition, the more liberal and the nationalist, and once an alliance between them might have seemed pretty unlikely or maybe next to impossible, but that it's sort of my understanding that some liberals think that Putin's an even bigger threat than the nationalists are. So is there any – what sort of possibility would there be for the liberals, the progressive liberals and the nationalists to somehow come together around the idea that they can work together as a united force against Putin?
Well, it's I think it's certainly an uncomfortable and uneasy alliance for some, and there will be some nationalist groups that are going to simply be beyond the pale and too extreme to be acceptable to the mainstream of those that are coming out in the streets, you know, that are more representative of this kind of growing middle class we talked about earlier. Now, the other you know, historically in Russia, even the liberals themselves, I mean, the biggest problem they've had is actually being unified, going back to the early 1990s. And that has really impeded and constrained the effectiveness that they've been able to have electorally and in affecting Russian policy. So that in and itself is a challenge. And then you add on to this other more extremist nationalist groups, and it's going to be a challenge for this opposition to maintain unity. And I think we're going to see, certainly, like we're seeing, and for the demonstration tomorrow, some splinters leaving the mainstream.
So now there will be a presidential election, and I think in about a month. Is March 6th?
The 4th.
The 4th. Okay. So truly in about a month. And I think that the expectation is that Vladimir Putin would win, ultimately would win. But now it seems the big question is, will he be able to win in the first round of voting, or will they have to be a runoff? And I think, in fact, just recently, Mr. Putin himself has said he thinks that perhaps there will have to be a runoff, that he won't be able to win in the first round.
In order to win in the first round, he's got to receive at least 50% of the vote. Right now, his polling numbers have been running around 40, low 40s. They have climbed a bit from where they were around the time of the parliamentary elections at the end of last year, but what he said, as I understood it, was that you know, not winning on the first round would not be a tragedy, but
yes,
it wouldn't be far from a tragedy from his standpoint.
Yes, because there would be so much trouble and unrest, and that which should be so bad for Russia. I mean, he does this thing where it's sort of like it's him or chaos.
That's right. He is the father of the nation. He is, and he's there, you know, holding, you know, preventing all of the chaos from inside the country and the external threats, and he's holding them at bay. And you know, without a really strong affirmation of his leadership, that would be threatening to Russia's stability and threatening to Russia's national interests. So he's kind of conceded a little bit that, yes, I can accept this, and I think maybe implying that, you know, we don't think it, we will not take significant measures to falsify these results in order to get the 50+% on the first round. But, you know, you can see by the what he says and how he says it that he's really not comfortable with that.
Yeah. Questions again, welcome. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about Russia and Russian politics. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Cutchins. He is a senior fellow and director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, someone who is internationally known as an expert on Russia's politics. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, is there anyone, certainly there are some names that come up again and again, but is there anyone who would be in a strong position, an individual who could stand for president, who would be in a position to make a really significant challenge to Mr. Putin?
At this point, no, I don't think so. I mean, we have the usual cast of characters: Gennady Zyuganov of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, who actually gave Boris Yeltsin a really strong run for his money in 1996, and may well have actually won the election and results of, but had been cheated out of victory. We have Vladimir Zhirinovsky, lively head of the ill-named Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, the most nationalistic and bombastic of Russia's politicians. You have the head of the Just Russia Party, Sergei Moronov, who had been closely tied with Mr. Putin, and but is not a particularly charismatic figure. The only new figure that we have on the scene today in this election, and it's an interesting case, is the billionaire owner of the New Jersey Nets basketball team, Mikhail Prokhorov. Mm-hmm. And Prokhorov is certainly trying to curry favor with this emerging class and this constituency of those that are dissatisfied with the status quo and would like to see Russia, you know, really move into a direction of kind of fulfilling the promises of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of a liberal and democratic Russia that is actually more closely tied and more tilted toward the West. Prokhorov does not have much of a history in politics. He was briefly his first foray was in the summer and fall of this year, where he took the leadership of a new party, Pravaya Dela, Right Cause, which had been approved of and was kind of a Kremlin project to create a political party that would appeal to this part of the electorate that feels that their interests are not represented. His polling numbers running at 4 or 5%. Now, of course, he says that his own polling numbers are a bit higher, but you know, I don't think that he's going to for him to come over 10% would be a great victory at this point for him.
Yeah. Another name that I've seen quite a bit, although he's not someone that I think has declared as a candidate, but has talked about forming a party, is the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin.
Right.
Who is he, and is this someone who has some political standing?
Well, Kudrin was finance minister for more than a decade, and did a terrific job as finance minister under Putin. I mean, Kudrin he's one of these very, very bright economists from St. Petersburg that emerged in the middle and late 80s, along with Anatoly Chubais and a number of others. His stature internationally as a finance minister is extremely high. But he's never had, you know, any experience in electoral politics or party politics within Russia. He is certainly someone that's been talked about as a potential prime minister. In fact, when Putin and Medvedev on September 24th announced the switch of their tandem and that Medvedev would become the prime minister, it was just the day after in which Kudrin announced some of his major differences with the government over some of their spending policies, particularly over military spending, and the response was that he was fired and thrown out of the government. I think there may have been some disappointment on Kudrin's part that he was not identified at that time as a prime minister, but that could still be a potential that could still potentially happen for him after the elections. We'll have to see. He's also announced, though, as you alluded to, David, that he's interested in establishing and supporting a right centrist party in Russia. So we'll just have to see.
Okay. Just maybe you could talk for a little bit about Mr. Medvedev and you know, when Mr. Putin was coming to the end of his time as president, and it seemed that his hand-picked successor was this man, Dmitry Medvedev, and I'm sure that probably only people who really followed Russian politics even, you know, knew who this man was or had heard of him before. You would see the two of them together, and Mr. Medvedev is younger than Mr. Putin, certainly. And there were times when it just looked like, you know, it was a guy out with his dad who was vaguely dissatisfied with his son. But, you know, your son's your son, so you got to hang with him. And clearly, Mr. Medvedev was the junior partner in this relationship. So how has he done as president? And does he have really anything in the way of a power base of his own?
He really doesn't have much of a power base of his own. And I think there were high hopes amongst many in Russia and outside of Russia at the outset of his presidency, and that he really would be the modernizing Russian president that would, mm-hmm. you know, kind of take Russia into a new era. and kind of roll back some of the policies that Putin had instituted in the previous 8 years. It unfortunately for him, it turned out that he was a lot more rhetoric than he was action. And after a year or two, I think there was a growing disappointment in liberal circles in Russia that this was the guy that could actually, you know, move Russia in a different direction. He really had an opportunity about a year ago, and in the spring of 2011, where he could have established himself as a more independent politician, and that he would have had to at that time basically announce that he was running for president, and that this was nuts, and he was doing this on his own. At the time there were increasing signs of differences between Mr. Putin and Medvedev on policy issues having to do with the Arab Spring and other issues. But Medvedev did not take that opportunity. And I think he really missed his historical chance, if there ever really was one, to kind of move more independently and establish it himself. And then what, of course, happened on September 24th when the two of them came out and announced that they not only were they simply planning on switching their positions, but that, in fact, this had been the plan all along, which, frankly, I don't really believe going back 4 years. But there are two impacts of that. One, I think it really further inflamed the dissatisfaction that people were feeling with the regime, that their interests were not taken seriously, and the politics were just a complete joke and a sham. It was insulting and it was humiliating, and it was especially humiliating for Dmitry Medvedev. So his political capital, I think, is deeply, deeply tarnished. And while Putin had announced his plans back then that he would like to have Mr. Medvedev as prime minister, and he's repeated that on a couple of occasions, I think that would be a mistake on his part, because it would further inflame the existing opposition.
We're talking this morning in this hour about Russia, Russian politics. Our guest is Andrew Cutchins from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Questions, comments are welcome. Hour 2 today, our monthly show on dog care and dog behavior. Celeste Quinn will be hosting the show. Next week on the program, on Tuesday in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Bob Biersack, a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. We'll talk about campaign finance, election reforms, and we'll certainly be talking about the current influence of the super PACs and of the Supreme Court decision that made this phenomenon possible. Then also next week, Tuesday, in the 11 o'clock hour, our guest is Dr. Lisa Randall. She is a physicist and is author of a very interesting book that is titled Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. So she'll be joining us next week. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Always welcome questions, comments. You can go to the website to get the schedule and also listen to past programs, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Dr. Andrew Cutchins. He is senior fellow and director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, well known for writing about, talking about, following Russian politics. He's visiting the campus, a visit sponsored by the folks at the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. So we'd like to thank them for making it possible for us to talk with him, and, of course, thank him for being here. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to talk a little bit about Russian foreign policy, mm-hmm. and one thing in particular, and right now, certainly one of the things that the United States, European governments, Arab League, they're all wrestling with is what to do about Syria. and how to address the really brutal crackdown of the Syrian government against its political opponents. And for some time now, there has, I think, been in the United Nations a strong sentiment that they want to make a strong statement that this crackdown has to end. And there are some people who, in fact, think that a statement should be made that Bashar al-Assad should step down. And it seems that the Russian government, in addition to maybe the Chinese and the Indians, so some other people as well, but the Russians particularly are standing in the way of the United Nations taking a real tough stand here. What is the interest of Russia here? Why would they be doing that?
Well, the Russians, I think there are several motivations on the Russians' part. One of them is economic. They have, you know, with the sanctions that were taken against Iran, economic loss to Russia is estimated to be upwards of $13 billion in trade, arms sales, et cetera. With what happened with the collapse of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, Russian economic interests, commercial interests were also hurt there. Russians have significant economic commercial interests in Syria, and that's one factor that is driving their position. The second factor is, you know, with the if the Assad regime falls in Syria, that further diminishes the capacity of the Russians to be a significant player in Middle Eastern politics. They have lost a number of allies and supporters, and that is a concern. And they do have a naval base in Syria, Tartus, although it's one that has not been used to a great extent by Russian forces, but that's also a factor in their considerations. I think the larger issue is the sense that, I mean, the Russians are sort of generally opposed to economic sanctions, and they're deeply opposed to the idea of regime change, especially regime change that comes as a result of Western military intervention. And they feel that their acquiescence to the UN Security Resolution 1973, which allowed for the intervention in Libya to protect the civilian population, they feel, and I heard Putin talk about this, you know, personally in November. I mean, he was really wound up about this, that this was an egregious violation, rudely way overstepping the mandate of what the Russians thought this resolution allowed for. And to paraphrase the old movie Network, you know, they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here with Syria.
Yeah. Well, there can I don't know how closely you've followed this, but I suppose then the question is, can something, and I'm sure that this is what they're trying to do in the United Nations, can something be crafted that will help, that will put some pressure on the Assad regime, that you get the Russians to sign on to?
You know, I don't. That's a possibility, David. And I know they're working on this hard in New York. And frankly, I think that the Russians, at the end of the day, would like to find a face-saving solution for them, so they would not find themselves in a really isolated position. Objecting to this. And the other thing I should mention is that the Russian foreign policy at large, since the September 24th decision that Putin was coming back, whether it's Iran, whether it's Syria, whether it's the missile defense issue, which has become much more contentious in the U.S.-Russia relationship, tone and rhetoric is one thing. The Russians are taking much more vociferous and stronger positions on issues which they see where they're simply counter to their interests, and both the tone and the content are more reminiscent, I think, of what we saw in Russian foreign policy in 2007 and 2008. So, you know, the question arises is, you know, how much does Mr. Putin's return, how is that actually going to impact Russian foreign policy? Well, it looks like we're going to see a much tougher defense and assertion of Russian interests than what we saw in the 3 or so years with Mr. Medvedev as president. Of course, he still is president. Then there's also the question, to what extent is this rhetoric, this tough rhetoric, you know, being employed hopefully to resonate with the Russian people in an electoral season. Mm-hmm. I think that's a piece of it. I don't think it worked very well in the parliamentary elections, but I think that's part of the explanation, but it's hard to say just how much.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk in a moment, perhaps we talk specifically about the missile defense issue. But generally, maybe we could talk a little in general about U.S.-Russia relations. And certainly it was the case that I think when George Bush left office, things had soured considerably. And the Obama administration came in and famously said, we want to hit the reset button. We want to see if we can make a fresh start here. And at least certainly that was the intention. So generally speaking, how would you characterize the relationship today between Russia and the United States?
Well, I think it's a whole lot better than where it was at the end of 2008 or January 2009 when the Obama administration came to power. The U.S.-Russia relationship was at its lowest point at the end of the Bush administration, lower point than it had been in the nearly 20 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, maybe even going back to before the 1980s, before Gorbachev and Perestroika and the new political thinking. And they've a number of key achievements, and one of the landmark achievements, of course, was the New START Treaty ratified by the Congress at the end of 2010, civilian nuclear power cooperation, so-called 1-2-3 agreement, achieved at the same time. The number one driving motivation for the Obama administration had been Iran and the Iranian nuclear program, and of course the Russians had signed on to the most recent and toughest sanctions on Iran. A significant and important cooperation in Afghanistan, and particularly facilitating the supply of our troops in Afghanistan through the Northern Distribution Network, new transit corridor, and then of course the support for Russia's WTO accession, which was finalized and agreed to by the WTO in December of last year. So I think there are a number of major achievements, and I think the Obama administration, in changing some of their policies, well, one, they were fortunate in that the NATO expansion issue was kind of off the table after the Georgia War. Our European allies were even more opposed to that than they had been before. And they made the decision to scrap the Bush administration missile defense plans that would have had deployments of rockets and other system components in Poland and the Czech Republic, and it was replaced with a plan which the Russians perceived as less threatening to their interests, at least at the time, a couple of years ago. And I think we also saw a reduction of our conflicts, you know, in the post, what we call the post-Soviet space. And I think there was some growing sense of trust that we were not out to undermine Russian interests all across the board, which was the Russian perception with the Bush administration. So I think there were considerable achievements, but I would say that the reset probably it peaked a little bit more than a year ago at the end of 2010, and in 2011 we found the relationship more mixed, and that growing. You know, that the administration identified two major goals for 2011 in the context of the reset. Mm-hmm. One was finding a modus vivendi and cooperation over the missile defense issue. That didn't happen. And in fact, the issue has gotten much more contentious and the Russian rhetoric tougher. And achieving the WTO accession. We did get that. And sort of the other set of issues that has been where there's been aspects of cooperation and contention we've talked about has been the Arab Spring. And, of course, things have come to a head with Libya and Syria. So I think the reset kind of helped to normalize the relationship. The relationship was really in an abnormal place that didn't serve the interests of Washington or Moscow several years ago. There were areas that we had common interests and we've been able to work together on. You know, now there are issues that we agree upon, we don't agree upon, but it seems that we've plateaued, and I think there's increasing question about, you know, what the future is going to be for this relationship.
Yeah. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Cutchins. He works at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's the director of their Russia and Eurasia program. We're talking about Russian politics, U.S.-Russian relations. Questions welcome 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I wanted to have you talk specifically about this, the issue of the missile defense system that's said to be deployed in Europe, and I think it's supposed to be operational this summer. And the Russians are not happy about it. They have not been happy about it forever, really, in spite of the statements by the United States saying, look, this is not about you. We don't think that you're a threat. This is not about attacking Russia. This is about a countering a different kind of threat. But the Russians don't like it anyway. What exactly is it that we're talking about doing?
Well, we are the phased array system that we're deploying. There's a series of deployments that take four different phases that would take place over the course that are taking place right now, and then would be concluded by about 2020. Mm-hmm. And of course, our contention with the Russians and others is that this system actually has quite limited capabilities. And it is designed to address a very modest missile threat that is principally directed toward Iran.
Right. Yeah.
And the Russians have, or another rogue state that would develop this kind of capability and threat. Of course, North Korea is an issue as well that we're concerned about. The Russians have not accepted the argument, and they're arguing that particularly in the fourth phase, that the system would start to have some capabilities that would be useful in addressing possible the Russian strategic deterrent. Now, that's I think there is a genuine difference over technological capabilities of the system. But what the Russians are more concerned about, I think, is that, well, you know, we know you Americans, you know, you don't want to stop there. And ideally, you would like to have invulnerability from any kind of missile threat. And so it's not necessarily specifically the system which we have planned for deployment over the next eight years, but what is going to happen in the future, mm-hmm. which we are not in a position right now to actually specify, you know, what the plans are, but the Russian perception that, you know, eventually we're going to have a system that would be threatening to Russia's strategic deterrent. And for the Russians, the problem is that because of their conventional military, the reductions in the effectiveness of their conventional military capabilities, they're that much more. Their nuclear deterrent is that much more important to them. So this, the missile defense issue, which you suggested, has always been a bone of contention for us going back decades to the Reagan administration's announcement of the Star Wars initiative in the early 1980s. It gets right into the frontal lobe of the Russia's strategic wheelhouse, if you will, to mix metaphors. And it's one that Putin, in particular, has decided to really emphasize in this electoral season. There still may be a possibility that in 2013, once we get through electoral seasons in both countries, that we may be able to come back down to the negotiating table and find a way to work out the issue, but it doesn't look like that kind of progress is going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. The United States, a number of the governments, are very concerned about the nuclear ambitions of Iran. They do not want to see Iran develop nuclear weapons. And, of course, Iran, I think the government of Iran, their official position always has been, well, we're not really interested in developing nuclear weapons. We're interested in the peaceful development of nuclear energy, that, you know, we're not into building bombs. But the concern is otherwise of the United States and other governments. Is Russia in any position to exercise any kind of leverage over Iran to perhaps persuade them that it would be better not to go and develop nuclear weapons? I mean, you wondered, does anybody really have any leverage on Iran? And if anybody does, might the Russians?
Unfortunately, I think the answer is no. Right. And Putin actually tried quite hard with the Iranians 2006, 2007, 2008 with various proposals to support Iran's civilian nuclear program and to propose for the disposition of spent fuel that emerged from that. And his efforts were rejected by Ahmadinejad at the time. And that's where it is. The Russians don't have that kind of leverage with Iran. The Russians don't want to see Iran have a nuclear weapons capability. But and here's getting back to the previous question about the missile threat. The Russians' assessment of the imminence of Iran having a capability differs from ours, and they just don't see it as threatening. And secondly, they're certainly not willing to, spend the blood, treasure, and political capital that we are with Iran. And Russia has a different set of has a wider set of interests with Iran. In some ways, Iran is a geopolitical partner for Russia in Central Asia, and also in Russia's concerns about what's happening in the Caucasus, particularly the North Caucasus region. So it's a different calculation that the Russians have than we have.
Mm. We have a couple of minutes here left. One of the things I'd just like to return to for just a second, that one of the things you mentioned as a positive, or at least I'm sure that the Russians would have seen it as a positive, was their being admitted to the World Trade Organization. And that announcement was made in December, and it was something that they had wanted for some time. As I read about this, there seem to be some people who, however, say that really there's more in this for the other members of the WTO than there is for the Russians, and that in fact they don't really have all that much to gain by being in the WTO. What is in this for the Russians?
Well, I think overall this is a positive for the Russian economy, for them to take the measures to qualify for accession to the World Trade Organization. World Bank studies and other bank studies suggest that there could be a pretty significant increase of 2 or 3% to Russian GDP over time with these measures taken. But there are going to be winners and losers in this, and Russian manufacturing is going to face increased challenges by tariff reductions. Russian agriculture is another potential loser in this. So there are mixed interest, but overall, I think it's positive for the Russians. Now, the big challenge for the United States, of course, is that assuming the Russian Duma ratifies the WTO accession, that's going to happen sometime, I think, in the first half of this year. That will finalize Russia's accession to the WTO. But if we, the United States, do not award Russian permanent normal trade relations status, which would involve with revoking the old anachronistic Jackson-Vanik Amendment, then Russia would join the WTO, and we, the United States, would not be a party to it, and we would not be able to use WTO trade adjudication measures to pursue cases to where we thought that Russia was in violation of its trade practices, and we would also not benefit from the tariff reductions that the Russian accession would require.
Hmm. Well, so we have about a minute here, just to return to the subject that we had been talking about right at the beginning, the fact that indeed there have been recently in Russia demonstrations, political demonstrations, like we haven't seen in a very long time.
20 years.
So people really unhappy about the state of Russian politics and wanting Mr. Putin to know it. And that people, maybe it's inevitable that they'd want to draw some sort of parallel between what's happened in the Middle East over the last years. And people are indeed, you know, using the trope and they're saying it's the Russian spring. Well, is there in fact any way in which what is happening in Russia is actually like what has happened, what we have seen around the Middle East, or is that really the wrong kind of metaphor?
Well, I think the metaphor has some applicability to the Russian case, despite the Russian authorities' protestations otherwise, mm-hmm. and that this will never happen in Russia. But you know, you have an authoritarian and corrupt regime. Which certain parts of the population are increasingly dissatisfied with, and they're ready to express themselves and to come on the streets for change. And I think there is some commonality to what we saw happen in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere in the Middle East with what's happening today in Russia.
Well, we will leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Andrew Cutchins. He is a senior fellow and is also director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Visiting the campus here is a visit sponsored by the folks in the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. We want to say thanks to them for making it possible for us to talk, and thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, David.